Welcome to Mobility Matters. I'm your host, Tyler Reeb, and today's podcast focuses on bringing equity and mobility to Indian country. More specifically, how can tribal technical assistance programs in the future improve access, safety, and economic opportunities in Indian country? To get a better sense of why tribal transportation matters to all Americans, one need only consider that Americans drive on roads and bridges every day that have been built and maintained by tribal governments. That critical transportation infrastructure requires a skilled workforce prepared to design, develop, operate, and maintain those systems. Until very recently, the U.S. government supported tribal transportation workforces through what were known as Tribal Technical Assistance Programs, also known as TTAPs. There is consensus that the Federal Highway Administration will soon reconstitute the TTAP program, causing many to wonder what the new program will look like, how it will operate, and who will define its mission-critical priorities. To get a better sense of the who, what, where, when, and whys and hows of tribal technical assistance, I'm joined by Ron Hall, a tribal transportation legal expert, a founding member of the Transportation Research Board's Standing Committee on Native American Transportation Issues, and president of Bubar and Hall Consulting. Ron, thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure, Tyler.
We've talked a great deal. I've learned more about tribal transportation from you than anyone. It occurs to me that a useful analogy is one that you've shared with me before. The best way to understand what a TTAP does is through comparing it to a walk down a state DOT hallway reading door signs. Do you mind sharing that analogy, Ron?
Absolutely. You know, tribes have the same responsibilities for the life cycle of transportation infrastructure as their peers at the DOTs. They operate within a more complex environment, but the essential requirements to do right-of-way clearances, do the environmental processes, having the ability to do on-the-ground surveys and project management, knowing what materials, you know, having testing capabilities for the materials going in, doing quality assurance, quality control of the construction projects, doing road maintenance, having the equipment on hand for whatever the environment is for that particular tribe, with motor graders, water trucks, dump trucks, it goes on and on. Interesting thing, whenever I get an opportunity and I'm in a state DOT, and I've been in a few, when you just walk, whether it's in the big cubicle section and or place with a lot of offices, just seeing the experts that are have jobs, full-time jobs, to do specific tasks for that DOT related to some aspect of their transportation infrastructure. And then knowing what I know of the tribal counterparts and the many hats that the tribal transportation staff have to wear sometimes, or the complex contracting out for consultants to fill those gaps. However it happens, those functions have to be fulfilled within a tribal context, the same as what you see happening at the DOT. And I'll also add that DOTs do a lot of contracting out. So not only do they have a lot of in-house expertise in the many disciplines, they also really leverage the consultant community to bring needed skill sets and equipment or whatever it might be.
To get a sense of how much work and what's involved, and you've done a great job of recapping that, it is fair to summarize that Americans drive on tribally built roads and bridges every day. These are not roads and bridges and related infrastructure for tribal communities alone, but rather part of our national network.
Well, in part, I mean, the tribes inherited a infrastructure network that they are now charged with figuring out how to make that infrastructure function in the modern context. So prior to 1991, which was not that long ago, 100% of that infrastructure on tribal lands that is considered federally owned roads. So the Bureau of Indian Affairs owned network. And there really, prior to that time, wasn't a tribally owned system out there. And even today, that's a very small amount of road that is tribally owned. In 1991, Intermodal Surface Transportation Efficiency Act was passed, and that created the mechanism for self-determination contracts. And the law behind 638 contracting, which is something that anybody in the tribal communities knows very well across all Bureau of Indian Affairs programs. In 1991, the transportation program became subject to that provision of law. What that did is gave the tribes the authority, legislative authority, to contract to take over what was previously a federal function done by the Bureau of Indian Affairs and make it a tribal program. And then to take the money that would have otherwise gone to that local BIA agency and channel it through tribal accounts. Prior to that, tribes were not involved in having any of the, you know, responsibilities or the authority or the capacity to do any aspect of the transportation program other than approve a list of priorities that the BIA would bring, and they would concur or add to that list of projects, and that would go forward for funding purposes. So the tribes inherited those road systems that were designed, planned, built by somebody else. And so really around the turn of the century, around 2000 is when tribes started really building up their capacity to go out and really build projects and redesign and operate as owners of that infrastructure.
With assuming the responsibility in 91, did that inform the development of the Tribal Technical Assistance Program to provide that technical support for the tribes to assume this new role of stewardship?
It did. And it turns out that in that same ICE-T law, they authorized, Congress authorized creation of the Tribal Technical Assistance Program centers. It was authorized in 91 and soon thereafter implemented. I came to work at Colorado State University to work in the Tribal Technical Assistance Program in 1994. So I think they had the contract for a year or two before I arrived.
And then, as I understand it, you ran that for two decades after that.
I did, for 20 years. And the region that I worked in was the Four Corner States. So Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, and Utah.
And there were ultimately seven different regional TTAP areas, that being one of them.
That's right. It didn't all happen at once. In that first round in 1990, the first round of contracts, I think there were four centers, and then it grew later into the seven.
What were your biggest successes during that two-decade stretch running the Four Corners TTAP?
Every day was a win. You know, I go to work and do outreach, have established a great network, listserv, and so on with the tribal transportation community out there. People were hungry for information, and our role was to do training and technology transfer. And so the great and massive investment that the federal government has done over the years in research and in technology development and so on for transportation, whether it's the infrastructure itself or the signage or the other parts of the system, every detail of that comes from a specification and has gone through rigorous analysis and study, and is always under something new coming down the pike. Our function at TTAP was to try to find those technologies that were appropriate for what tribes were trying to, the problems tribes were trying to solve, and make those connections. And some of it was very surprising, I would say. Like the biggest one that I thought was very rewarding was that in the work zone traffic control area, there was a national push to improve safety and make sure that work crews had the right signs and trained flaggers and so on, so that people working on the road and the traveling public were safe while these activities are going on. And we surveyed the tribes, and they really didn't have the stop sign paddles or the cones or other things, warning signs to post so many yards ahead. So they put together a collection of these needed tools, and we were able to take them around to the tribes and show them, do training. This is a, you know, work zone 101 and how it works. These are what you need to have to do it. And when we were able to leave with them some of the cutting edge signs, you know, with strobe light fixed to the stop sign or whatever. Anyway, that was very rewarding. surprising that there wasn't anything there that the tribes assumed from the Bureau of Indian Affairs that matched up with that. They didn't inherit a safety program. They just inherited the responsibilities to do the work. And so adding that component of keeping people safe while they're doing their jobs was very rewarding.
What would you say your biggest challenge was running a TTAP?
The biggest challenge? Well, the resources to do training, heavy equipment training was always a challenge. Getting the equipment where the people that needed the training could get it. Oftentimes, travel budgets and so on are used by leadership on a local level. The guys that are out there operating the machines are, you know, usually stay home. They don't go to the conferences. They don't go to the other events, but they're the ones that need to know the right techniques to properly, say, maintain a gravel road. We tried several different angles at supporting a training center in the New Mexico region, having a place where folks could go and get in-seat training. And we were just never able, it was always a liability question, an insurance question, or some snag. We never did have success putting that together.
So getting people in the cab in heavy equipment and training them so that they can be safe, effective operators of this equipment that's at the cornerstone of good infrastructure construction and management. That was the kicker, huh?
Well, I was there. The motor graders had been motor graders for years and years. And then all of a sudden, the joysticks started to appear and the computerized GPS-enabled systems started to appear. For people that were used to just jumping on the machine and going, throwing them behind the seat of one of those new technology motor graders or name your equipment, they're all impacted by that now. But keeping current with the technology is really important.
After two decades at the Four Corners TTAP, you transitioned into a new role. I also think this is probably where you use your law degree nationally, working with tribes around the country to develop transportation infrastructure projects, addressing workforce challenges. What prompted you to make the shift, Ron, and what did you learn in this new role working more broadly with tribes around the country?
Well, you know, I really wanted to get back to some real project level activities. So within the TTAP, I was able to support, you know, ongoing training and research, and we conducted administered the National Tribal Transportation Conference, and we were able to host the first two National Tribal Transportation Safety Summits. Getting that network in place and sustaining, you know, those partnerships between all tribal folks and programs and federal counterparts, state DOT, industry counterparts. All of that was very rewarding, but I didn't ever really get to see a project through. So in my transition, I'm able to work on actual long-range planning projects and strategic planning and help with writing grants and getting resources to a tribe that has a specific need. So I'm able to be more hands-on in that process. I think make a little different contribution. And within my law perspective, I don't call it my law practice, but I take on an approach of proactive, preventative law. I try to get the solutions and identify issues ahead of the trouble spots and get the training, the information to the right people within the tribe so that they know the parameters of what the issue is that they're working on legally, and then they're able to move forward before the need for lawsuits or complaints and that nature. So leveling the playing field with the knowledge of the law, whether it's, you know, the specifications or the requirements of the whatever aspect of the transportation program, having the tribal side of the table up to speed and with their information already in hand when those discussions and negotiations take place, just makes the system work. That's really where my interest lies.
This brings up one of the I think most difficult things to understand about tribal governance. As I understand it, I was looking at stats. According to the National Congress of American Indians, there are 574 sovereign tribal nations that have a formal nation-to-nation relationship with the U.S. government. Hearing you talk about the importance of proper legal representation for tribes, this factor here seems to make things that much more complicated. So as a legal professional, Ron, what does that mean, number one? What does it mean to be a sovereign tribal nation with a nation-to-nation relationship? And what does that mean legally for tribal governments trying to build out roads, maintain roads, make sure bridges are safe, make sure their workforces are trained and safe?
Well, it makes an incredibly complex situation. And if you study the legal opinions that the U.S. Supreme Court came up with the concept very early on in the earliest the U.S. Supreme Court opinions that tribes are governments. And the U.S. in its formative years needed a mechanism to have a legal claim for land, to be a landowner in the Americas. So they came up with this concept that tribes are government that have the authority to transfer land, and that they have, in those early decisions, all of the aspects of sovereign power that any other government would have. So in the international community, tribes have the same legal status from a sovereign perspective. They can impose taxes, they can buy and sell land, they can impose regulations, they can go to war. Through that process, that's kind of the original position. And then since then, it's been recharacterized as tribes being quasi-sovereigns and having lost certain aspects of their sovereignty based on their domestic dependent nation status, which is the buzzword that gets used, the phrase. And so the tribes in their negotiations and relationship with the U.S. government no longer have that international sovereignty. They can no longer do treaties with Canada or with other nations. They can only do commitments with the United States. So the courts infer this, make these rules. But through that process, you know, the tribes had treaties with the United States, treaties within the hierarchy of law. When you look at the United States legal system, treaties actually rank above the Constitution in terms of their legal authority. So when the United States makes a treaty, that treaty is held to be a sacred thing. It must be followed. It has certain obligations that go through with it. So we are seeing that treaty process became cumbersome as the balance of power shifted from tribes being a dominant military numbers force, and as the numbers started to dwindle, as disease and other issues created U.S. military dominance across the continent, the U.S. stopped in the late 1800s making treaties and shifted to executive orders and legislative enactments. But those are said to have found to have the same level of enforcement and so on. Use of the treaty mechanism. There are 574 tribes, and within that 574, there's just, you know, really great diversity from land base. There's a large number of very small tribes. In Alaska, there's over, I think, 220 tribes alone, recognized tribes and villages in Alaska. In the state of California, there's 115 or something of that nature in the state of California. And then on the other end of the spectrum are the large land-based tribes. And I believe when you look at what number of tribes have the most infrastructure within them, it's, you know, you look at the top 20 and you'll find that like 80%, 90% of the infrastructure that's being managed is actually located, that's federally owned. That's a federal right-of-way, is within 20 tribes, have a vast majority of that. The rest of the tribes rely on county and state roads and have to figure out ways that they impact their, you know, impose their systems, their policies and priorities and so on within their land area on a road system that they don't own. And that is a challenge. And another complexity of this is the Indian Commerce Clause, which is part of the U.S. Constitution, states that the federal government has authority in dealing with tribes on matters of commerce, and that commerce has been interpreted to mean everything. So any dealings with the tribes is a federal constitutional power. And that leaves the states kind of on the sidelines. But, you know, on a day-to-day basis, when tribes are trying to deal with transportation issues, it's the states and counties that are owning the roads that the tribes are trying to address, whether it's a safety issue or maintenance issue or whatever. So that makes things very complicated, keeping the relationships in line with what the Constitution says.
As I mentioned earlier, and as you know, Ron, the TTAP program is directed by federal statute, and there are processes underway to reconstitute the program. When you think back on your experiences running a TTAP, when you think back on your experiences working broadly with tribes and seeing where the needs are, where do you think the mission critical priorities should be for a program that provides tribal technical assistance in the future? I'm hearing loud and clear that there has to be legal expertise built into this. I'm hearing from what you're saying that there is a need to sort out the jurisdictional confusion between the decision makers at the local, county, state, and federal levels. What else would you say you'd add to your mission critical list?
When you look at the way that all the technical expertise and the way that policy is formed within the U.S. transportation system, as far as with the infrastructure side of it, the surface transportation side, it's not even close to a level playing field. The states have an organization called AASHTO, which is the gold standard for the mechanism to find consensus between all 50 states on transportation-related issues, you know, those things that need to be national priorities and national standards, and to continue to study and refine and put effort into those things. Tribes are not involved in AASHTO, don't have a seat at the table in AASHTO, and maybe appropriately not. I mean, they're not part of the states, but there is not a tribal equivalent. So the tribes don't have a body where they convene themselves with subject matter experts, internal subject matter experts, to look at whether it's a policy issue or an issue of science or engineering or something, planning, environment, those types of decisions. That really, to me, was something that TTAP was fulfilling and building until it came to an end recently. But the need for a tribal AASHTO is, to me, one of the big voids that's out there.
If you were to explain what the value proposition would be for tribal governments to have a tribal AASHTO, what would that mean? Would it serve as a clearinghouse for all of the various activities and services so that there was an organized framework to understand the unique role that tribal governments play in American transportation, or is that too tidy of a summary?
Well, I think it just function wise, it would help the tribes articulate to Congress the full scope of their transportation needs in a way that has been well vetted ahead of time. I'll give you an example. When the new highway legislation is coming forward, there's always been debate within the states about how the highway gas tax should be distributed. So you get the small urban states versus the large rural states and trying to carve up that piece of pie. Tribes are no different. There's so much diversity within the tribal 574 tribes in terms of circumstances that they're trying to meet on a local level that has not been the subject of that kind of rigorous discussion within the tribes of how do we get our, what kind of funding formula, or what kind of funding mechanisms do we need to have in place that actually addresses the needs of the tribes? So that happens, and to build that kind of consensus. In my opinion, in the absence of that, tribes that have sophisticated relationships with their congressional representatives and are able to lobby for their positions, or even within the administrative side or on the congressional side, they're doing their homework. They figured out how the game works, and they're in there, you know, advocating for their needs. I applaud that. But on the other hand, there's a huge number of tribes that don't have that ability and that presence in DC to advocate for their interests and needs for transportation, and they're left out. A few interests being addressed and a large amount of interest being not accounted for.
Ron, as always, thank you very much for your time and your expertise. It's always appreciated, and look forward to continuing discussions with you about all these important issues.
My pleasure, Tyler.